I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Doctors at the JFK hospital are overwhelmed by the wounded and running out of supplies. There are rebels in Maryland. And the child soldiers in the capital city loitering under the Star and Stripes are reported to be stoned and dangerous. Well, familiar as the place names sound, this is a story about Liberia, the African country with perhaps the closest ties to the United States. You see, Liberia was largely built and developed by Americans, former slaves who returned to Africa hopeful for a new home. More recently, this West African nation has endured a brutal civil war, years of lawlessness, and is now in the hands of yet another cruel dictator. Connection listeners, this hour we explore the historic links that bind Liberia and the United States and look at the growing calls for U.S. intervention. Here's the question. Does the United States have a moral or a political obligation to the people of Liberia? Should that be based on historical ties or just common decency? And what difference does it make that the U.S. is already up to its elbows in Iraq and Afghanistan? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll be speaking today with people who know this relationship well between the two countries. We're going to start, though, with the latest news, and for that we go to New York, where the BBC's Greg Barrow was yesterday watching an emergency debate at the United Nations. He's joining us now. Hello, Greg.
Good morning.
The emergency debate, I gather, didn't come to any conclusion yesterday. More to come in the days or weeks ahead? What's up there?
That's right, and I think most of us who cover the United Nations didn't expect a great deal out of it. This was a meeting that was called in response to a letter that the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan had sent to the Security Council over the weekend, in which he said there was an urgent need for the deployment of a multinational force to Liberia, mainly to protect civilians and police any ceasefire that emerges on the ground. So the response of the Security Council was to meet less than 24 hours later, discuss this idea, but generally speaking, this is not something the council can act on immediately. And the main issue is who would lead such a force, who would provide the heavy lifting, the logistics, get the troops on the ground and make sure that once they're there, they could do something effective. That question hasn't been answered yet. And until it is answered, the hands of the Security Council are essentially tied.
Now, the Security Council does have a team in West Africa now, a group of diplomats, I understand. Are they looking specifically at Liberia? Will it be information that they provide that moves this ahead?
The information they provide will certainly assist the Security Council in making its decisions in the coming days and weeks. I think it's really quite coincidental that that mission happens to be in West Africa at this particular point in time. It was due to go earlier this year, and then its trip was postponed because of the Iraq crisis. It's ended up in the region at a very opportune moment. So those diplomats, some of them very senior UN diplomats, are going to see it firsthand what's happening on the ground. Now, although they're not going to Liberia itself, they say that for security reasons they can't fly to Liberia, they are meeting with representatives of Liberian groups in neighbouring countries like Ghana, and they're also speaking to the leaders of other countries in Sierra Leone and Guinea-Bissau, countries that have been affected by the spillover of this lawlessness and long conflict in Liberia. I think it shouldn't be forgotten that this instability in Liberia is not new. It's been going on for more than a decade, on and off. It sparks and fizzles over the years, and we're going through a particularly bad stage at this particular point in time.
Now, Greg, the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, was in Geneva, I understand, yesterday speaking about this. I wonder if we can just, between the two of us, listen to what it is that Kofi Annan was saying, and then I'll come back to you after that.
Just as we've seen in recent past, the UK working with the West African and UN peacekeeping operations to calm the situation in Sierra Leone, the French taking the leadership of the multinational force in the Congo and also helping in Cote d'Ivoire, there are lots of expectations that the U.S. may be prepared to lead this force.
And Greg Barrow, that's precisely what you were talking about, that the U.N. needs some strong nation to say, okay, we're going to commit 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 troops, and then around that a multinational force is built?
That's right. I think we've seen an evolution in the past 10 to 15 years in the way that the United Nations deals with conflicts. Around about the early 1990s, you saw the UN sending peacekeeping troops, blue helmeted troops, into conflict zones and trying to get them to sort the problems out. These were often lightly armed, not necessarily the best trained or the most properly resourced bands of troops, and they often ran into problems. What we've seen in recent years, and you can look to Afghanistan as an example, to a certain degree you can look to the Democratic Republic of Congo recently, where a French-led force was sent. What you've seen is the Security Council saying to a nation that has a particularly good army, particularly good resources, very well-trained troops, by sending a few of those to lead a bigger force, they can sort the problem out much more quickly and much more efficiently. So they're in a sense looking for the real military muscle from nations that have that those kinds of resources. And he mentioned there that recently the British had sent a force into Sierra Leone that had generally calmed matters down there. The French this year, in fact, sent a force into the Ivory Coast, where there's been a lot of instability recently. That has also had a calming influence. And there's a pattern emerging here. These are nations being sent to their former colonies. And the reason I think there's a great deal of attention on Washington at the moment are the deep historical connections between America and Liberia. And so in the mind of the Secretary General, I suppose it makes sense for the US to step forward here and say, yes, we'll make a commitment here, we'll lead this force, or we'll at least make it happen, we'll provide the logistical backup for it.
All right, Greg, thanks for your help with this.
Thank you.
Greg Barrow, BBC correspondent reporting from the United Nations. Joining us now from the NPR studios in Chicago is William Reno. He's a political science professor at Northwestern University and the author of numerous essays and books, including Warlord Politics and African States. We also have with us John Prendergast. He is co-director of the Africa Program at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was director of African Affairs at the National Security Council and an advisor to the State Department under President Clinton. John Prendergast, I'll start with you if I can, and I'd like you, if you would, to just pick up from where Greg left us off. Is there an understanding, an acknowledgement, a recognition in Washington that if a force is to be put together, it will have to be led, or most likely have to be led, by the United States?
Oh, that's hotly debated. I think there are many advocates that would have the West Africans police the or take the lead in policing the ceasefire. In other words, the what is called the ECOWAS, which is Economic Community of West African States, regional organization for West Africa, would take the lead in doing that, and we would support it some way, which hasn't been determined and is being determined in the next couple of days. The other advocates say, no, U.S. leadership is absolutely required in this case, and the debate is on.
Determined in the next couple of days. Are you saying that there are people at the State Department today who are talking about what the nature of the American involvement will be in Liberia?
Sure. There's a process that major decisions like this usually goes through that starts at the working level, then it obviously goes up to the number twos around the government. Now it's at the number ones around the government in each department. Today they're meeting, they're discussing. We're understanding that probably state is going to support U.S. forces being involved in some kind of a mission, and the Pentagon is opposed to it. Therefore, it's going to be a presidential decision because he'll have to break the tie.
All right, John, stay with us because we'll be going back, and with our callers, too, to the current responsibilities of the United States. But, William Reno, I need some help from you, a little bit of history, if you'll indulge us. When we talk about the historic links between Liberia and the United States, is it always going back to the return of the slaves in the early 19th century?
Well, for practical purposes, given the current crisis, the relevant American historical relationship with Liberia really goes back to the 1970s and the 1980s.
Okay.
Because as the country entered a political crisis, the U.S. government played a very key role in trying to negotiate first reforms, and then as conflict began, to try to encourage different parties to find some sort of peaceful resolution. But there are a couple critical points at that where the United States has begun to exercise influence but then pulled away. And I think one of the moral arguments for intervention now is to look back at those earlier instances and ask the question, could the United States have made this conflict less serious if it had followed through in the 1980s and early 1990s in some of these efforts.
But William, when we talk about America's obligation to the people, to the country of Liberia, we heard Kofi Annan earlier in the program, and Greg Barrow echoed that there's a something of a comparison here, where England has a responsibility for the African nations where it colonized, and France the same, Portugal the same. Does the United States have that same perspective of Liberia, that it's got some kind of historical obligation to at least stay connected to the country?
Well, historical obligation, if one wants to look back at colonial history, U.S. has ties to Liberia going back to the early 19th century. But I think the political question arises, how relevant is the period of colonialism in determining who should intervene in Liberia? Mm-hmm. I mean, should it necessarily be the former colonial power? And that may become controversial later, as some people see this as a reimposition of colonialism or some kind of less strenuous kind of outside control.
Right. And
But certainly those ties go back quite a long ways, more than 150 years.
But you'd have us also look back, 18 years to when Samuel Doe, who was the leader at that time, in effect stole an election, and the U.S. turned a blind eye instead of wading in, saying, no, that's not right. I mean, it's that sort of history that you think has more importance today?
Yeah, I think that's a more important history, because that's a history that the political class in Liberia, the sorts of people that the U.S. would have to deal with, that's a history that's most relevant to them. So, for example, in 1985, the U.S. State Department had played a very large role in trying to get the old dictator to hold multi-party elections, which he actually did. And the suspicion was that the opposition won the election in 1985. The dictator waited to see what Washington would do, and he didn't see any kind of forceful action, any kind of forceful statement from Washington. So, in the view of most people in Liberia, he then stole the election and continued in power for another 5 years and to the disaster that we see now.
And John Prendergast, just in measuring the disaster that we see now, is this a completely failed state? Is this a country where, with some quick intervention, the nation could be back on its feet?
I think with regard to your first question, I think it's one of these states that has been hijacked by a commercial elite led by Charles Taylor, whose objectives have been to, and Professor Reno in his writings has been one of the key people in elucidating this, to collapse the formal economies throughout the region to the maximum extent possible by providing assistance to rebel groups throughout the region in order to drive commerce underground. And you've got diamonds and other natural resources there that are very lucrative. So he's made hundreds of millions of dollars by being the biggest gun on the block and being able to corner the trade on diamond exports from around the region. So the commercial objective has absolutely worked. So it's not a collapse state in the sense that they can't exercise authority, but it's what they exercise the authority for, which is personal enrichment of a small elite, which is a major problem in Liberia.
Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk more about Charles Taylor, certainly a key figure in understanding the relationship between the United States and Liberia today. And we're also going to look further into whether or not the United States has a moral or a political obligation to intervene in this country's ongoing violence. We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And as the violence raged last week in Liberia, President George Bush weighed in with his view of the situation.
In Liberia, the United States strongly supports the ceasefire signed earlier this month. President Taylor needs to step down so that his country can be spared further bloodshed. All the parties in Liberia must pursue a comprehensive peace agreement. and the United States is working with regional governments to support those negotiations and to map out a secure transition to elections. We are determined to help the people of Liberia find the path to peace.
But at that time, President Bush didn't make any specific promises about American involvement in trying to untangle the mess in Liberia. As pressure continues to mount for the U.S. to intervene, this question continues to dog administration officials. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, spoke yesterday to reporters.
We've spent time over the weekend, a good deal of time over the weekend, visiting among ourselves about that and thinking through different aspects of it. The reports out of Liberia tend to come up and go down in terms of urgency or lack of urgency. It was relatively calm there, the latest reports. And that's a call the president would make if and when he decided to make such a call. And he has not, nor has the State Department requested an evacuation out of Monrovia.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking yesterday about calls for American involvement in Liberia. As I mentioned earlier in the program, we have with us today John Prendergast. He is co-director of the Africa Program at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C., and William Reno, professor of political science at Northwestern University and author of a number of books, most recently Warlord Politics and African States. And William Reno, you have some personal history with this man whose name keeps popping up whenever we talk about Liberia. Charles Taylor sent you a note saying, don't come back to my country.
Well, his agent sent me a note and said that I had said a few very nasty things about his government and that I was no longer welcome in Liberia and that there would be consequences if I returned.
Do we need to know something about this man, Charles Taylor, to understand what's going on in Liberia? Is the situation or the circumstances we're talking about now very much of his own making?
Yes, I think so. And oftentimes there's a danger of personalizing conflicts. But I think that this may be about the best argument that conflicts really can be about individuals. And it goes back to what John Prendergast said about how Charles Taylor rules, that he doesn't rule through building government institutions or real strong coercive agencies, but rather he rules through controlling commerce, through controlling clandestine economies, monopolizing economic opportunity, and then distributing that in a big patronage network to his friends.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that he also has so much history in meddling about in the affairs of the states that surround Liberia. You would think that the people there would be doing their darndest to try and make sure that the man was out of there as well.
Well, and this manner of rule means that he becomes economically involved with all sorts of other groups in the region, including rebel groups in Sierra Leone, in Guinea, in Cote d'Ivoire. So he's very destabilizing for his neighbors. And most of the neighboring governments, there's certainly no love lost for Charles Taylor, but they lack the capacity to be able to really do anything about this.
Now, there's a fairly gruesome side of the people who continue to kill the dictators and take over power in Liberia. This story of videotaping executions. What do we know about that?
Well, this goes back to Liberian politics of the 1980s. When Samuel Doe, a prior dictator, came to power in 1980, he had the cabinet of the previous government killed on the beach in Monrovia, a popular video. This became called Liberian Beach Party, and one could purchase this in Monrovia.
On the black market or just in one of the shops?
Oh, well, just on the street. People were selling the cassettes. And so in 1990, when Samuel Doe was killed, not by Charles Taylor, but by a split-away faction leader, that was also videotaped, and that became available.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're talking about the links between the United States and Liberia, the situation in that country, and the calls for U.S. intervention. Let's go first to Boston, and Conrad's joining us. Hi, Conrad.
Hi. Thank you so very much for taking my call. I have lived and worked in Liberia for a number of years before moving on to the United States, and I happen to be originally from Ghana. I have also happened to have met Charles Taylor a couple of times when he was a member of Samuel Doe's cabinet. And what I want to say is that the people of Liberia do not deserve Charles Taylor. What people need to understand is that Chancellor managed to get into power through the auspices of Gaddafi. That's common knowledge. And if he continues to remain in power and the United States allows that to happen, he's only going to make the whole regional situation worse. He's a thug. I mean, this guy has absolutely no interest in you know, taking care of the needs of the people of Liberia, who, by the way, are one of the most peace-loving people you ever find anywhere in Africa. And I happen to have traveled around Africa quite a bit. So I think that the U.S. has a moral as well as a political obligation in helping, in stepping in immediately and helping to make sure that Chancellor is removed right now.
Conrad, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. John Prendergast, I'd like to hear from you on the pressure that just that Charles Taylor creates for the U.S. to move in there and take a more directly involved role in helping untangle the mess in Liberia. Is he, as William Reno was saying, someone where, you know, the personalization of the conflict actually works in this case?
Yeah, I think we have, every administration, Republican or Democrat, is idiosyncratic in its foreign policy interests. And in this case, in this administration, I think there are people who really do want to see Charles Taylor gone. And for President Bush to call on a sitting president to remove himself from office is rather extraordinary, actually. And it only happens in the case, well, when we gear up with 200,000 forces to take out a certain government in the Middle East.
So is it a hint? When Bush stands up and says the man must step down, is that a hint that Bush may in fact be willing to put some muscle behind that call?
I'd use the word warning rather than hint, and it may be a false warning because the Pentagon is so opposed to this kind of a thing. But that doesn't mean that the president, when he makes his mind up about something, won't do it. It just puts him on record now as saying that this is what the policy objective of the United States is, which changes the dynamic a little bit and has to put a little concern into Charles Taylor's mind, that's for sure. And that's the point. It's preemptive deployment of public diplomacy, basically. It's using potential actions in the United States.
But how much of it, John, how much of it has to do with the fact that the president knows he's getting on Air Force One next week and has to step off the plane in Africa and doesn't necessarily want to answer some hard questions about what he may be perceived to have not been doing?
Yeah, I think it 100% has to do with that. Then, you know, if we wouldn't be having the kind of raging debate inside the U.S. government right now about whether or not to deploy U.S. forces in Liberia in a situation where the ceasefire is not holding if President Bush wasn't going to Africa next week. Certainly they'd be discussing it, but it wouldn't be an urgent debate. So there is urgency as a result of what his foreign policy and domestic priorities are pushed forward by this trip to Africa and some of the statements he's made now publicly. He really wants to come across as someone who cares about Africa, and that would simply it would ruin the trip if he goes and does all these good things that he wants to do, mm-hmm. but we didn't do anything about Liberia.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Framingham, Mass. Now, and Matt's joining us. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that, in my opinion, we simply cannot afford to continue these low-level guerrilla wars. We may feel there's a moral obligation in Liberia, and there's absolutely no question that Taylor, like Saddam, like the Taliban, these are repressive, horrible regimes. But, guys, we reach a point where we can't afford it anymore. There are so many ills in this country, both social and economic, that are being masked, and all we're continuing to do is try to take the light off of these by running around in the world. Biggest problem is we have a short-term goal. We're going to go in, we're going to threaten it, we're going to talk, we're going to carry the big stick. Long-term, we do nothing. We find ourselves in these different cultures trying to force the two Chevrolets in a garage, everybody drinking vanilla Coke, down the natives' throats. And we had no clue. We were told that Iraqis were going to welcome us as liberators.
So, Matt, are you saying that the United States ought not to get involved in Liberia because there's no way they can get in and get out within
exactly.
a predictable period of time?
Exactly. And the question is, how many of these little whatever you want to call them, wars, what, you know, can we afford to, you know, can we afford as taxpayers?
Right.
I mean, it would be, you know, it would be one thing if we were, we saw our taxes, say, going up.
Right.
Where somebody said, hey, look, we're going to be the moral guys, we're going to be the good guys. But if Bush had the, I guess, the fortitude to actually say, look, people, to be good guys, it's going to cost you some money. We're going to actually have to increase your taxes.
But Matt, I want you to stay on the line for me for a minute, if you would, because we also have on another line Professor Patrick Sion. He's currently a research fellow at Boston University's African Studies Center, but was president of the University of Liberia and helped draft the constitution of that country back in the early 1980s. Professor Sion, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm interested in having you respond to what Matt's saying, because I get what Matt's saying. You've opened the New York Times every morning, and how many U.S. soldiers have died or been injured in Iraq, and what's going on in Afghanistan, and how can this country afford yet one more involvement? What would you say to make the case for Liberia?
You know, his position is understandable from the American perspective. From the Liberian perspective, the United States owe Liberia and Liberians a whole lot. If you go back to the early period of the 19th century, when the U.S.'s economy depended on agriculture and slave labor, most of it, and slavery was still intact here in this country, free slaves moving around created a problem for slaveholders and plantations, and Liberia proved to be the answer where those free slaves could be removed under the moral standing of returning them to Africa.
But you're still in a position of making the case to an American taxpayer who's wondering how many soldiers, how many U.S. soldiers can be deployed in how many places around the world. Are you saying that there are Americo-Liberians, those free slaves and their descendants living in Liberia, who actually see themselves as having direct historical links with this country?
Maybe that's too far back in history. Let's move forward to the period of the Cold War. During the period of the Cold War, Liberia served as the center for the CIA Near East and Africa. And it was during that period that Doe came to power. And now the United States preaches democracy, and we're happy that it wants to make the world free for democracy and free trade. But back then, Liberians were agitating for democracy, and their efforts at creating a democratic society and state were frustrated by the United States because it saw a direct linkage, I don't know how, to the evil empire that President Reagan at the time saw. And because of that, the U.S. supported the rigging of the 1984-1985 elections in Liberia. And Chester Crocker, who was then Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, claimed that you couldn't have an election in Liberia like a Vermont town meeting.
All right, Patrick, I wonder if you can just hang on a second here, because I'd like to go back to Matt in Framingham. Matt, you're hearing the story through Liberian eyes and ears, and I'm wondering whether or not there's anything there that is making you think there a case can be made for U.S. involvement in Liberia.
I understand, certainly, and even, you know, don't consider myself really cold-hearted and can certainly empathize with what he's saying. My case, the point that I'm trying to make is simply we can't afford it. You know, history is fine, but it's like anything else, guys. That was then, this is now. It's like any type. I mean, you're actually trying to make it sound almost like, you know, the whole thing is reparations. Well, gee, my people came down from Canada as a bunch of displaced Frenchmen in the late 1880s. You know, they didn't have slaves. As a matter of fact, they probably weren't living as good as most slaves when they first got to Maine. So the simple fact of the matter is we just can't afford it. History, everything else, what's happened, what's come before, we have to live in the here and now. our children have to live in the here and now.
All right, Matt, I want to turn to John Prendergast on this, and thank you for making that point on the program. Appreciate it. John Prendergast, the argument that you're hearing, is that in any way a sort of civilian version of what's going on between the State Department and the Pentagon right now?
I think it's representative on so many things. Government is always about competing priorities, and the truth is globalization intensifies. We're citizens of the world, not just the United States, and we really can't bury our heads. Liberia, in fact, won't be a blip on the budgetary radar screen, given the huge increases in defense spending that have been proposed and will likely be approved by Congress. We really do, in fact, and he's absolutely right, the caller, we have to be very careful about the deployment of our forces around the world, and we have to have strict criteria. But the truth is, again, that there have been no U.S. combat forces in Africa since Black Hawk Down, since the 94 in Somalia.
Right.
And that's almost a decade now. And the U.S., in the case of Liberia, has a comparative advantage. Everyone around the world is looking to U.S. leadership. There is no other situation in Africa that currently the United States is thinking about inserting combat forces, and there probably won't be anywhere anytime soon.
John, I want to stop you there because I want to get just a last word from Professor Sion. And Professor Sion, I mean, it seems so much of this has to do with American involvement in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Do you think the case can be made?
Well, the case can be made on two grounds. First of all, the historical connection that the U.S. has had all along with Liberia. Secondly, that given the global dimension, arms flow to Liberia, particularly starting with Doe, is America's direct connection to the conflicts that have, been blowing up in parts of West Africa.
So you're saying American involvement in Liberia at this point would be a way of calming the conflict, not just in that country, but in Sierra Leone and
Ivory Coast.
All right, that's a good point, and I appreciate your joining us on the phone to make it on the program today. That's Professor Patrick Sion, research fellow now at Boston University's African Studies Center, was former president of the University of Liberia. Connection listeners, the number's 1-800-423-8255. There are powerful reasons to say why the United States ought to be involved in at least helping bring about an end to the violence in Liberia. But as Matt in Framingham was saying, can we afford it? Is this the time that the United States should be getting involved in another conflict like this? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is A Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the historical links between America and Liberia and whether or not that is a mandate for America to lead a peacemaking, peacekeeping force to stop the violence in Liberia at this time. With me on the program, John Prendergast. He's co-director of the Africa Program at the International Crisis Group in Washington, author of a number of books, including Frontline Diplomacy, Humanitarian Aid, and Conflict in Africa. William Reno is also with us. He's a professor of political science at Northwestern University and has made Liberia one of his principal areas of interest and scholarship. And William, I haven't heard from you in a few moments, and I'm wondering, as you listen to people make the case for and against American involvement, if you can cast your mind back to the time that you were living in Liberia, and if you can draw from that either an example or a person or an experience that somehow helps us understand the link a little bit better than perhaps we do now.
Well, originally, I lived in Sierra Leone before I moved to Liberia. And upon arriving in Liberia, it seems very much like sort of a takeoff of the United States. The Lone Star flag, nice hotels, the beer is better in Liberia than it was in Sierra Leone, screens on the window and so forth. And people talk a little bit like people in the United States and wear the same kinds of fashions as people in the U.S. So just for the casual observer, the connections are very obvious to the country. But one thing when I first arrived in Liberia that I noticed was quite different was this problem of Liberia's involvement in neighboring countries mm-hmm. that later becomes something that aggravates conflict in Sierra Leone and in Guinea and in Côte d'Ivoire. So in that sense, it's both very much like the United States, but it's also quite different.
And of course, always important for people there to emphasize their closeness to the United States. We saw the people in Monrovia last week holding up their cardboard signs. George Bush, we have to have your help. You know, we don't see that in Sierra Leone or Côte d'Ivoire.
Well, that's right. So if there's a U.S. intervention in Liberia, chances are it's not going to be opposed by average people. I think most people on the streets of Monrovia would welcome this intervention. All so right. I suppose it would be easy, at least from that point of view.
Let's go next to Raleigh, North Carolina. Denise is on the phone now. Hi, Denise.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I was calling because I'm an American Liberian who's lived here for 20 years because of the beginning of the whole war with Samuel Cato and everything. And I was basically calling to say that the U.S. should intervene because they are intervening in the war in Iraq based on the fact that Saddam is a tyrant and he's violating human rights. Is Charles Taylor not a tyrant to the entire region, and is he not violating human rights?
But if you go with a simple test like that, you'd have America in 19 different states at the same time, Denise. I mean, they'd be in Burma, they'd be in all sorts of places, wouldn't they?
But they're still having to do with the backlash of Liberian citizens being here and immigration not implementing things to help those people. They essentially become liabilities for the state, and we as taxpayers here have to pay for them being here. So how does the U.S. deal with that problem?
I mean, when you look at the mess that's there right now, the number of people who have been pushed out of Liberia into neighboring states as refugees, the number of people who are displaced in Liberia itself. I'm wondering, Denise, in your view, whether or not the United States is afraid of getting involved because it would end up being a greater involvement than just funding a couple of thousand troops on the ground for a few years, but it would mean that the United States is a little bit uncertain about getting involved in such a big refugee and displaced person issue like that. Do you think that's a part of the hesitation?
Well, I guess based on what's going on in Iraq, I see the same thing happening because now the U.S. is intervening and talking about doing things in Iran. Is that not the same region? Is that not dealing with refugees from that region, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan? Is that not the same thing?
John Prendergast, you know how the people in Washington gauge and weight these issues. Are they thinking of Liberia at the same level as they're considering Iran and Iraq and the people in those countries?
Well, I'm sure Denise would be happy to know that what she's just said scares the hell out of the Pentagon. This is kind of thinking that they fear the most. I mean, it would be a flood of demands without any political strategy that the U.S. military would just go in place after place and to try to, quote, restore order. So there has to be a set of criteria that any government applies to decide whether or not to send troops in. And on that list of criteria are the following. First, that there's some kind of comparative advantage that the United States presents. And Kofi Annan, at the outset of your show, very clearly delineated, hey, Sierra Leone was the British responsibility. The French went into Côte d'Ivoire, into the Ivory Coast, and made a difference. Now it's the U.S.'s turn in Liberia. Second, it has to be a mission possible. I mean, they have to be able to accomplish whatever the objective is, whether it's to pacify the country or simply protect civilians. They have to be able to do that. Third, there has to be either some kind of historic responsibility or some kind of strategic interest. In the case of Liberia, you have that. And finally, there has to be some kind of compelling humanitarian argument. So all four of these things, I think, apply in the case of Liberia, and this is why it's become such a difficult thing for the Pentagon to say no. I think they will say no, and therefore President Bush will have to decide and overrule them, if he will. But otherwise, it just isn't a strong enough case in the Liberian situation to have the Pentagon say, yeah, let's go in.
And William Reno, isn't it also further complicated by the fact that even if Charles Taylor leaves or is forced from office in Liberia, there aren't many options of people who are ready to replace him. And I mean, neither of the rebel groups are the sort of people who would want to run a country, are they?
No, the rebel groups don't present very good opportunities for replacing Charles Taylor. Most of these groups are proxies of neighboring governments that have been involved in their own conflict with Charles Taylor. So there's a danger that once Taylor's removed, if one turns to the rebel groups, then this will just continue the factional struggles. They're civilian politicians who had been involved in this liberalization in the 1980s and then a very brief one again in 1997. Some of those politicians may enjoy a pretty widespread support, at least among some groups in Liberia, and that may be where the U.S. or the U.N. or whoever turns for a successor to Charles Taylor.
And William, take that one step further for me, if you would, because Liberia is a small country. It's about the size of the state of Tennessee. I understand there's about 3 million people there. I mean, it's not like Congo. It's not like Iraq. It's not so big and unmanageable, is it?
No, it's not big and unmanageable. And I think that this is something to argue in favor of intervention, is that it would be a fairly simple case in that it would be a friendly population by and large, the people who would want to see intervention. Logistically, it would not be that difficult. And I think one of the things pointed out earlier is it's part of a package that with a prior British intervention in Sierra Leone, in a related conflict in Sierra Leone just to the west, and the French intervention in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, just to the east, that unless the Liberian situation is dealt with, it always has the possibility of destabilizing its neighbors so that those other efforts on the part of other countries may come to naught if the problem in Liberia is not dealt with.
Let's go to Elizabeth City in North Carolina. Marjorie's now joining us on the line. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling. What are your thoughts about this?
I think that we ought to have a plan in terms of anywhere that we enter our troops.
Do you mean a plan to get out or a plan to actually help and fix things in that country?
A long-term plan. Because what often happens is, I'm a professor of public administration.
A planner.
So what I think is that we ought to get together with the people from Liberia.
Yeah.
Much like we did with the Iraqis.
You mean Liberian refugees, exiles Liberian living in this country?
Not necessarily refugees, but Liberian planners,
yeah,
intellectuals, all the people that have Liberians' best interest in mind, to plan a long-term strategy for the country. Because it's in our best interest to have a place where we can have free trade and more trade. And I think if Liberia settles down, Cote d'Ivoire will settle down, Nigeria will settle down. I think the whole area is in our best interest to begin to develop a relationship with Africa proper.
As a point place where the Americans would be welcome to go in. All right, it's a good point, Marjorie. Thanks for that. I want to turn to John Prendergast on this because, John, I know you've got a little checklist of what comes first and what comes next. And, you know, the first would be that the U.S. goes in and the second be that the Security Council would sanction Charles Taylor. Then there'd be some kind of control of the rebel groups. But Marjorie is bringing us to the what comes next then. What's the plan? How do you create a political atmosphere in Liberia where the country has at least the wherewithal to begin governing itself again?
Absolutely. Well, that's a fundamental point, and this is the principal argument of the Pentagon and others that oppose this kind of thing, is that we're often, and again, Iraq and Afghanistan may be Exhibit A and Exhibit B, we're often going in with military force, overwhelming military force, but without a corresponding political strategy that's very clear to outsiders and clear to the people which are recipients of these so-called liberations. And then, you know, what's next? And so that's being asked in Liberia. What would be next? And the answer is, and it's being constructed now in peace talks in Ghana, is that there would be some kind of a weak interim administration, a caretaker government for a year and a half.
Liberians?
Liberians only, with strong international support and supervision. And that would obviate the usual feeding frenzy for immediate positions, to say that, hey, we're just not going to support a robust interventionist, strong central authority. The international community won't support that kind of thing. We'll support a weak one and prepare for elections. And during that electoral preparation period, there'll be aggressive efforts by the international forces at disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of forces, because the security threat to this country that is posed by these continuing operations of the militias, who have, and these kids have absolutely no economic alternative. So it's going to have to be a lot of reconstruction and reintegration assistance for the providing livelihood alternatives for people who otherwise only have the gun as their recourse for survival. So that, I think, is going to be part of the plan. It's a political transition as well as an economic revitalization.
And William Reno, we talk often and hear often people talking about the importance of getting Africans to take care of African problems rather than always turning to the Europeans or the North Americans. And I'm wondering if we follow John's logic here to the point where someone needs to set up schools and centers where those child soldiers can be deprogrammed and taught to be ordinary citizens once again. Is that something where Africa has a record or the wherewithal to perhaps begin doing that without it all necessarily being run and paid for by Western taxpayers?
Well, unfortunately, Liberia is in one of the poorest regions of the world, and the money just wouldn't be there from Ghana or from Nigeria, for example. These are large countries in the region that are struggling with their own problems. I think there'd be more possibility for human capital, for teachers and so forth from the region.
From Nigeria or South Africa or some of the other countries that are a little bit further ahead economically?
Yeah, that's right. But in the case of Nigeria, a country with a per capita income maybe of $350 a year, a very, very poor country with quite serious economic problems of its own, it would be difficult to ask these countries to make great, at least material contributions towards rebuilding Liberia. I think it's important for those countries, however, that something be done about Liberia because, as I pointed out before, what modest gains have been made in places like Ghana, which is one country removed from Liberia, that if the conflict isn't dealt with, then I think it presents serious dangers to the gains that have been made already in places like Ghana.
John Prendergast, very briefly, what should we expect to see before the president leaves for Africa next week?
I think that there will be a decision by the president and along this line that he'll say something like, if the ceasefire holds in Monrovia, then the U.S. will contribute to a multinational stabilization force that monitors and observes that ceasefire. But if the Liberian people, if the Liberian factions sign things but then don't implement them, then we can't send our forces in. He'll halfway it. And that way, I think he'll try to please everybody. We'll end up pleasing no one.
John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Prendergast, co-director of the Africa Program at the International Crisis Group in Washington, D.C. And William Reno, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
William is political science professor at Northwestern University. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Patrick Seon, research fellow at Boston University, and Greg Barrow, the UN correspondent for the BBC. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.